This is the Bookmark Podcast from Scottish Book Trust. If you love books and reading, connect with us at scottishbooktrust.com, on Facebook, and on Twitter.
Hello, book readers and book lovers. My name is Ryan Van Winkle. Welcome to Bookmarked from the Scottish Book Trust. It's great to be here. We have a bountiful episode for you today. We're going to be talking about treasures, and not just the kind that are buried with an X marks the spot, but the stuff that, you know, might be in your home, hiding in your cupboard, on your bookshelves. Treasure could be a memory, something you hold dear. The Scottish Book Trust, every year, has a writing and reading campaign. And this year, our campaign is about treasures. We want your stories about your most treasured objects. Is there a special something that has touched or shaped your life? Is there something that holds a special memory for you, ties you to a person or a place that you remember very vividly? Send us your poems, your essays, your stories about this object. If you want to find out more, go to scottishbooktrust.com/treasures. There you'll find out how to submit your own story, read stories from other people, including celebrities like Richard Holloway and Denise Mina. You also find out about the opportunities for free workshops throughout Scotland. To kick off the campaign, we're going to start off with Denise Mina talking about her treasure.
This is a piece about a treasured possession of mine, which is my tea caddy. My treasure is my tea caddy. It's an old Co-op biscuit tin in grey metal with blue and yellow decorations painted on it. It's much faded, much battered, with a good fitting lid to keep the tea bags fresh. The paint has worn off around the handle where fingers have pinched once, twice, 10 times a day for 40 or 50 years, pulling the lid off, taking out a tea bag, fitting it back on. That wear and tear has eroded the paint. It has exposed a silver base coat underneath and finally the grey metal the tin is made from. And on the bottom in industrial type it says, United Cooperative Baking Society Limited, Glasgow, Clydebank, Belfast. The tin came from my gran, Winnie's house after she died. It was faded and worth nothing and nobody else wanted it. Winnie and I never liked each other. She was not an especially warm woman. But even allowing for that, we never liked each other. My earliest memory of her involves us being left alone in a kitchen and tacitly agreeing to pretend the other wasn't there. She was capable of warmth. She adored my big sister. When we were very small and sleeping at her house, she would get into the double bed we were in with a tray of roses, lime marmaladed toast and a wet flannel. And she always sat close to my sister and I was miles out on the edge of the bed watching them eat and giggle and wipe the sticky jam from their hands. I could lie and say the space between us was a source of sadness to me, or her, or both of us, but the truth is always better. That's how it was and we weren't much bothered. In big, big families there's always a sub for any position, and really I had my Auntie Betty for granny warmth and constancy. But Winnie and I spent a lot of time together. Wherever we went in the world, she would come and stay for months at a time. I can't remember a conversation with her that wasn't about finishing my dinner or her telling me about ladies. They didn't have a lot of scope for movement, ladies, poor things. A lady, said Winnie, doesn't rub her mouth with her napkin. A lady dabs her mouth at the corners. There were 100 lady do's and don'ts in my childhood, and Winnie always put on a strange, strangled sort of voice as she imparted them. Don't sniff. Don't look in the mirror. Don't bend down in the street to look at chewing gum patterns on a hot pavement. Don't shout at dogs. Don't eat Nutella with a spoon. Basically, whatever I was doing at any given moment was what ladies don't do. Poor ladies. But ours wasn't an actively hostile relationship. It wasn't spiteful, and she was certainly never mean to me. I think I was a bit mean to her. I got a witch puppet when I was 5, and I called it Winnie. I rolled my eyes when she told me about these ladies. I dodged her. I didn't visit when she was dying. Winnie had mental health issues, spent a bit of time in psychiatric hospital, was on mysterious medicine that made her slur in the evenings. She always seemed a bit fragile, but she was proud too. When she was a young lady, Winnie wore fox fur stoles. She teased her hair into a bouffant that seemed as high as a stovepipe hat, and she trained as a French polisher. It was a highly skilled 7-year apprenticeship. She had to give up work as soon as she got married. Ladies didn't work. She left her home in Bressey Road, Barlanock, to travel the world. Paris, San Francisco, visiting relatives, maybe giving them advice about being a lady. Winnie and I didn't like each other. That's how it was, and there was nothing we could do about it. But we both liked this United Cooperative Baking Society tin, and both of us used this tin every day. Once, twice, 10 times a day, Winnie and I heard the inverted kiss of a vacuum lid coming off. Poof. Once, twice, 10 times a day, we felt the warmth of a nice wee cup of tea in our hands, and possibly a biscuit.
How long was it before you settled on the biscuit tin? Was it something that was right away, the tea caddy as the treasured object, or did you have to skulk through your house and go, no, that's not it?
I wanted to write about something quite banal because I like things that you use every day, and I don't like things kept for special or, you know, things kept in a cupboard. I like things that get used, and I really love that tea thing. There's a thing about tea and making tea, and I think it's a very much a feminine role, and it's very much a gesture that women make, making tea for people, come in my house and have a cup of tea, you know, forcing tea on people who don't want a cup of tea. But there's a very strong, almost kind of primordial need to make something slight with like 3 or 4 movements for people when they come to your home. So there is a thing about making tea, and also it's quite an ugly object. There's also the whole history of the co-op movement in Scotland, which was massive. And my mother's family come from Rutherglen, where the co-op basically owned the whole of Rutherglen. And they had the whole of the main street, and everybody worked at the co-op. It was an integral part of the town story, was the co-op. And it was very much a kind of history of socialism and working class self-help. They had a butcher's, they had a milliner's, they had a baker's. You know, it was just a huge thing, and now it's just gone. They had absolutely everything, and it was a dividend system. So the more you bought, the more you got back. Everybody worked there, and it was just a huge cultural thing. And it just kind of evaporated, and I don't really know where it went.
Whereas obviously this is not just about the tea cozy, but it's also about Winnie. Had you written about your grandmother like this before, and was this a strange thing to delve into in such a personal way?
Well, I kind of wrote about her. My granny was a really, really interesting character, and I wrote about her. I think there's a real responsibility for writers if you're writing about people. They have to be dead 10 years, I think. You know, I wouldn't like to write about somebody who was recently dead or who's still alive, really, and put my point of view forward. Particularly, we had such a fractious relationship, my gran and I, that, you know, it's quite hard to talk about her without being disrespectful. But I did write about her in the Herald, and it was just a one-line thing, and it was one of those questionnaires, and it was, what did your granny teach you? And what my gran taught me was never to get drunk in a caftan that's too long for you, because that's just carnage. And I wrote that, and loads of people have asked me about it, and I realised, God, Winnie was a really, really funny woman. You know, she was always having adventures like that. And she went to visit these cousins in San Francisco, and she overstayed her welcome so long, they went on holiday and their teenage son locked her on the balcony and wouldn't let her back in the house. And then she came back from San Francisco with an American accent, which she used for the rest of her life. She was a very funny woman. I was kind of aware that it was a really interesting relationship, and it wasn't what you're supposed to have with your gran. But, you know, the truth in families is much more interesting than the sort of saccharine construction. And actually, we didn't really like each other, and she loved my sister, who was the firstborn, and then there were quite a lot of grandchildren, and she just wasn't much interested, and that was the truth.
Were you conscious of the story that was inherent in that?
A wee bit. And also, you know, you have to make sure it's not too personal to other people. I don't want to talk about my kids. I think the truth in family relationships is a really interesting thing to talk about, and it's quite freeing. Mm. And it's often funnier and more tender than, you know, I think there's something really tender about me having her tea caddy and both of us having used it, and that hand movement that wore away the paint, and just actually how much we had in common, whether or not we were best buds, you know?
Yeah, and I like that recognition of that you weren't best buds, but actually there's a respect and a love and a warmth there, of course.
And we still belong to each other. Yeah. You know, that's it. Even if you don't like your family, you still belong to each other. And you can still respect each other.
Has thinking about this project opened up anything else in the writing, is it?
I think it slightly makes you look at things a bit differently as anchors for stories, looking at everyday objects as anchors for stories. But I chose something quite banal because I hope it'll spark other people to, you know, I don't want to write about the biggest diamond ring I've got.
What are you working on at the moment? Is there anything on?
At the moment, I'm actually making a film about my family. So I interviewed my mother's family, who were like a family of 13 children. So we filmed them and did a documentary of them as if they were a minor European royal family, because they're very regal. They're not chippy at all. And two of my uncles went to Oxford, and and we made it into a documentary, and then we showed it to them and the rest of the family at the GFT, and we filmed them watching themselves. They had loads and loads of visitors. They had people living with them for months at a time, people from Trinidad, people from China. They had a priest from China living with them.
Is that going to be aired at some point? Well,
we're editing it just now, and then I think we're going to take it to festivals. We don't really know what we're going to do with it, but to be honest, it's a bit of a leap of faith because I don't really make films. But it's just to do things, you know, like I write comics as well, and it's to do things that are stimulating and to actually engage with the market, but also have an artistic life. It's a bit of a balance, isn't it?
There's an interesting thing there, though, because you said that you wouldn't write something about somebody who's not dead for 10 years.
Yeah.
This film... Yeah. They're all alive.
Yeah. No, because that's different, because they're speaking and they can represent themselves, and also showing it to them gives them the ability to edit it. So they can say, I don't want that in. And we left out any controversial stuff. I mean, it's, you know, pretty anodyne. And if anybody said, I don't want that in, we took it out. But I think if it's through your perception, you just have a bigger say, and it is your perception, and you choose the words and you represent them. And even just the fact of you speaking about other people is a different moral thing than filming people.
That really surprised me, because I thought you were going to talk about a TV show or a film.
The second Field of Blood is about to be aired. Scott Free are developing the Alex Morrow books as a TV show, but I don't really have anything to do with that. Usually I write a novel a year, and then when I'm not doing that, I have a bit of an off season where I get to do other stuff. So I just had a play on about Peter Manuel at Oran Moor, and I'm writing comics as well and making wee bits of films and stuff like that, and then I'll start the next book at some point in August.
Denise Mina, everybody. Thanks so much to her for sharing her treasure with us. Remember, you can submit your story and find out more how to be involved in the Treasures campaign, www.scottishbooktrust.com/treasures. It's that easy. Dive in. As I'm sure everybody listening knows, in April, the former Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, passed away. Damien Barr is a Scottish author, and he wrote a book called Maggie and Me, which was recently released. And it's about what Thatcher meant to him growing up as a child in Scotland through the 80s. Here he is from the I Write Festival in conversation with me, Damien Barr. Damien, I guess what a prescient title and time to release a book about Maggie Thatcher.
I know the timing does seem suspicious. She's on the cover of the book and she's in the title, and she very much dominated my childhood growing up in the west of Scotland, in Motherwell in the 80s. She was everywhere that I looked, everywhere that I turned. The book is certainly not, you know, a love letter to Thatcher or anything like that. It details quite clearly the very negative impact of her policies on culture and on my community and on my family. But I think it's really important to tell that story. I don't feel like it's a story that's necessarily been told.
And the interesting thing about this is, of course, it's not a political book.
It's not a political book at all. It's a very personal book. It's a memoir about what happened to my dad, who was a steel worker, and to my mum when she became very disabled. And it's about the kind of, I guess, fragmentation of a family and the things that can happen to children when parents aren't looking. It's also a book about stories and how stories can help you, can save you. And it's a book about friendship, the friends that I made and the friends who gave me a safe space. And it's a book about love in very unlikely places. It's absolutely not a misery memoir, but there are dark things in the book, just like there are dark things in everybody's life.
And that's something that I think that is also actually maybe even more resonant to me or of the times. I mean, this is a book about yourself growing up as a homosexual kid, yeah, and how you kind of began to accept that. And it seems to be there's a kind of a critical mass moment happening where things are changing. And it must have been really difficult. And you talked very eloquently about this in the book, about just names and not knowing what the names were.
I think, you know, I realized that I was gay, not because really of anything in myself, but because of the people around me who treated me in a way. They called me names, and names like Poof and Jesse and all the rest of it. And I didn't know what these names meant. I just knew that they meant that they didn't like me. And I began to find out what those names meant, and those names began to correspond with feelings that I was having. And that's kind of how I realized I was gay, not in any kind of positive way or in any kind of happy way, but through people's sort of hatred and suspicion. I think it's probably a bit different now, but I think you still go through that process of realization of I'm different. And I think that whether you're different because you're fat or whether you're different because your parents are divorced or you're different because you feel different. You know, gay is just another kind of difference, but at that time was not an accepted kind at all.
How does Thatcherism and that relate to each other?
Clause 28 was a really hateful piece of legislation which sought to prohibit the teaching of homosexuality in schools. And so when I tried to talk to my teachers about being gay, I was told legally they weren't able to help. And that was an evil Thatcherite piece of legislation which can't be forgiven. Thatcher did also have an ideology of individualism, and you can be different. You, as an individual, are special. And that is, I guess, the supposed silver lining, I guess, to that cloud for me. I don't seek to defend or deny any of the awful homophobic things that her government did, but I did manage to find my way to being an individual. And for me, that means being a gay man.
You said you had to write the book. What does that mean?
I went to bed thinking about it. I woke up thinking about it every day for years. It was driving me mad. I wanted to tell the story, and I worried that if I didn't tell it, I would kind of explode. I just felt like I had to say these things, and I wanted to say them in a way that was good and honest, and that's what I've tried to do in the book. But I absolutely had to do it. I had no choice about writing this book.
Did you try not to write it? Was there something you were avoiding?
No, for years I avoided writing it because I thought that it was self-indulgent to write a memoir. I also didn't want to upset my family or my friends. But in the end, I just felt that the cost of not doing those things was greater than the cost of doing them. So at some point, you know, there was a tipping point where I thought, right, now I actually have to do this, and I will.
How did you find the memory process work? Because that's something that always attracts me. Like, this idea of, like, you're calling up memories from 8, 9, 10, 14. Yeah. This is a while back now, and I'm guessing.
I think that the memories which come unbidden are the most powerful ones, and they're very often about something awful that has happened. But also they can be very happy. You know, extreme memories come unbidden. So actually I didn't have to try very hard to remember a lot of these things because they were just there waiting to be transcribed almost. Things that I had to try harder to get right were things like dates and times, and I think that's about being a journalist, you know. But actually, the broad kind of brushstroke and also the very fine details were a counterpoint for one another, and I was able to remember them quite clearly. I mean, there's a lot that I've written that's not in the book. The book has been cut and cut and cut and cut.
And you have to make it a story. A life is not a story, right?
No, a life. I have chosen to sit down and tell a story, and I want it to read like a story. And I had a very good editor, Alexandra Pringle at Bloomsbury, who, along with a woman called Louisa Joyner, said to me, you know, you need to think of yourself as a character, and you need to think of your story as a novel, and this will enable you, this will free you up. And actually, it really did, you know. Once it starts being about the truth and stops being about the facts, it's much easier to write.
You talked a bit about the power of reading, the importance of reading, finding characters in books when you were a young person, and how libraries are sanctuaries, yeah?
I think a book is a passport to another world and a ticket to another kind of life. It's a way of creating empathy and understanding between people, because you can imagine that you're somebody else. And books live in libraries, so libraries are the place where that happens. But also they offer sanctuary for people who need to get away from home for whatever reason, because it's cold or it's dark or it's dangerous or it's noisy. So libraries provide a really valuable sanctuary for people, and it's very important that we continue to have libraries with books in them so that people can go and have that space and access those other places. You know, books absolutely gave me hope because they showed me other places and times and people that I didn't know existed. And so my world, like most children's world, was very small. My world was also very dark and for the most part quite dangerous. But I did also have kind of points of light in that world. And one of those points of light was definitely books and the library. And actually, my parents always bought me books if I asked for them. And I remember being given books by social workers and things like that. So, you know, books have always been a luxury to me. And now that I work with books, hosting book events, and now that, you know, I've written this book, I feel very lucky to have made the thing that I loved into my life. That's a great privilege.
So how does Maggie end up weaving her way through the entire narrative?
Thatcher was always there when I was growing up, when maybe my parents weren't or other people kind of came and went. Thatcher was always there. So every chapter starts with a quote from her, and sometimes that quote is in the counterpoint to the narrative, and sometimes it frames the narrative in a positive way. But, you know, she closes closed the Ravenscraig where my dad worked. She cut the benefits that my mum lived on. She created care in the community so that my crazy aunt had to come and live in our house. She created Section 28, which made it difficult for me to come out of school. She privatised utilities so that we had to find 50 pence pieces. She created the poll tax. She did all of these things which affected my life very directly. So it wasn't that I had to reach for her. She was sort of always there, in a strange sense, some kind of other mother. But, you know, for the most part, I absolutely hated her and had every right to hate her for the things that she did to me. But as an adult, with some of the anger having gone out of that, I was able to maybe see some good, even if that was unintentional.
Maggie Media is available now at all good bookshops. Thanks again to Damien Barr for sitting down and talking to us. Thanks to the I Write Festival that happens in Glasgow every year. It's a fantastic time, and it's always good to be hanging out in the Mitchell Library. Absolutely love it. Now, imagine a future Scotland in which bears have been reintroduced to the wild. That's what Mandy Haggith's new novel is about. It's called Bear Witness, and we sat down to talk to her a little bit about where this idea came from.
I am mad about bears, which was the title of the book for a long time while it was in its various draft incarnations. And eventually I realised that, yes, you can't call a novel Mad About Bears. So it's called Bear Witness.
A while back you wrote a book about the last bear in Scotland, right?
Okay, well, the last bear was set 1,000 years ago, and it tells the story of a woman whose life is kind of wound up with bears. She's a manic kind of medicine woman character. It's the story of the extinction of the bear in Scotland, so it's the loss both of her culture and also of the megafauna that her culture used to revere. So Bear Witness is completely different. It's a speculation about a future where bears return to Scotland. In a very bizarre way, I suppose you could call it a sequel, but there's more than 1,000 years has elapsed in the meantime.
So when is the novel set?
At some point in the future in an independent Scotland.
Oh.
So, yeah, so it's quite interesting to bring it out at this point when that's obviously quite a hot political topic as well. So it's got a scene set in the Scottish Parliament and quite a bit of chat about whether or not the reintroduction of wildlife that has been lost can be part and parcel of Scotland kind of gaining a new identity for itself in the world, and that maybe indigenous cultures that live with bears, they have a very strong role as a symbol of rebirth. So the way that a mother bear goes into its den for the winter to hibernate and then reemerges in the spring with cubs is believed in many cultures that this is a symbol of dying for the winter and then being reborn again for spring. So there's that little thread that runs through it that maybe reintroducing a bear to Scotland would be a way of symbolising rebirth of the whole nation and who the people are here. The story itself emerged from the myth in Ovid's Metamorphosis of Callisto. And Callisto was the woman who was raped by Zeus, and then she was one of Diana's maidens and a virgin. And when Diana discovered that she was not, in fact, a virgin at all, she was banished. Zeus's wife Juno, who'd been watching and was extremely enraged both by Zeus for being unfaithful and by Callisto for being this desirable young woman. At the point where Callisto gives birth to her and Zeus's baby, Juno turns her into a bear. For me, that there's a strong story element there about what does that symbolise, and for me that's a symbolising of a woman learning basically to be wild and shifting from a kind of perhaps rather shy maidenhood into a much more kind of wild, bear-like, perhaps furious, perhaps active kind of creature.
Is this a utopian book? Is this Mandy's, like, are we going into your optimistic new world?
It's a dream, in the sense of what would it be like to make the transition from where we are now with the wildlife of Scotland to a future where we're actually able to consider bringing back the carnivores that we've lost. So in that sense, yeah, it's a utopic view. It's not as well, because in fact, I think in a utopic view of the world, the country would at some sense be endorsing this. But in fact, and I think closer to the reality of what will happen, is the state does not actually want to go through a process of reintroducing carnivores, and that there would be lots of controversy and not everybody would think that this is a good state of the world at all. So that's very strongly in the book, that it's a highly controversial thing that's going on, and it's the ways and means by which it is achieved are not necessarily straightforward, shall we say. One of the most fascinating things about fiction for me is the way in which the story gets its own life to it, and the characters do things of their own accord, which in a very bizarre way feels as though I'm not actually in control of it and of them. And when they do that, it's very thrilling, actually. You think, oh, okay, so maybe these have got lives of their own, and that's fine.
Is there any general sense that you have that this kind of thing, are you actively engaged in trying to reintroduce wildlife into Scotland?
Not in a hands-on way. I have been watching with absolute fascination the beaver situation, where, you know, what you have got is both, at the same time, an official governmental reintroduction process going on in Argyll, with officially monitored beavers. And then there's also the informal introduction of beavers, where they have escaped and have been very successful living happily in the wild in the Tay. There have already been really successful reintroductions of ospreys, sea eagles and red kites, so those kind of predatory birds have come back, and people go out of their way to go and actually see these animals. So I think there's a real scope for tourism benefits and so forth of bringing back some of the wildlife. And I support anybody who's trying to sort of take the steps forward that we need to do that. One of the claims that gets made about bears is that, well, we don't have the forest anymore that bears need as their habitat. That's a real active debating point. We are already taking great steps to restore woodland and forest areas, so the habitats are definitely improving. We're going in the right direction. The primary ecological impact that bears have is that they go around munching fruit and nuts. They'll eat lots of seeded bearing plants and then go out and dump them in other places with large steaming piles of manure, you know. So they actually their primary ecological role is to spread seeds. And so if we bring them back, actually we'll probably find that they'll help actively in spreading woodland and all of the species that they like. So we don't necessarily, I think, need to get to a point where we have optimum habitat before we bring the animals back, because they will themselves, in their very activities in life, they'll improve the habitats for us. A big part of this book is actually set in Norway and in Finland and in Romania and places where there are bears and different kinds of debates and conflicts happening in those countries. And my main character spends a lot of time actually in those other countries exploring those issues and finding out about it. So I'm kind of hoping that the book will be, it's got a lot of research that went into the back of it, and hopefully it'll be kind of educational to people about what the real possibilities are.
Did you find yourself kind of pushing against sort of some of the research that you wanted to get in, or some of the facts you wanted to have in, because it wasn't necessarily pushing the story and the narrative forward?
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's been a big part of the editing process, to have a whole mixture of characters who know different things and who can argue with each other, and through genuine conflict, which is moving the story forward, have some of the sort of thematic issues getting discussed as well. So yeah, I think that's absolutely right, that you can't just pile spoonfuls of research into a book in the hope that it'll somehow float, if every single bit of factual material has got to be doing something for the characters or for the story, either generating or helping to resolve conflicts along the way. And for me, that's why it's most fun to write a novel, to do these sorts of things, because you don't have those opportunities to make the conflict issues and the differences of opinions that are inevitable and real in the world. In a kind of non-fiction story, it's not necessarily so easy to dramatize those conflicts. In a novel situation, you know, you make those conflicts as real as you like by having real characters fighting with each other about it. So,
and whilst doing other things, while having life, having babies and exactly. Doing whatever it is people do.
Falling in love and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right.
Mandy Haggith, ladies and gentlemen. You can get her book, Bear Witness, at good bookshops and online everywhere. Thanks to her, Damian Barr, and Denise Mina for sitting down and talking with us. Thanks especially to Denise Mina for kicking off the Treasures campaign. Remember, go to thescottishbooktrust.com/treasures to find out how to submit your story and to read other people's stories about their favorite objects. You can follow the Scottish Book Trust on Twitter @ScottishBKTrust. Make sure to click on follow. You can like us on Facebook. And don't forget, there's a whole wealth of resources online at ScottishBookTrust.com. Don't forget to catch our other podcast, Book Talk with Paul Gallagher, which will be out in a couple weeks' time. Listen in. Until then, that's all for now. Keep reading, and don't forget to send in those treasure stories. Bye now. Bookmarked is produced by Colin Fraser with music from Ragland.
Thanks for listening to this Scottish Book Trust podcast. Find more book lists, stories, and interview blogs at scottishbooktrust.com and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter.